Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This Word in Your Ear is brought to you thanks to NordVPN. Now, remind me, Mark, what does VPN stand for?
I think you'll find it's virtual private network. That's my reading of the situation.
I think you're right. It stands for virtual private network. And also, I don't have to bother asking you if you know what virtual private network means.
I know, but explain to anyone who doesn't.
Okay. It means a way to keep your data safe on the internet whenever you're logging in, either at home or abroad or in an internet cafe or on your phone in a street in a distant capital. VPN, virtual private network, protects your identity and encrypts your data so that nobody can steal that identity. But there's fun as well, Mark. At the same time, it enables you to access the internet via servers in more than 50 different countries. So you can get up in the morning and think, where do I fancy logging in from today? Singapore or the United States of America or Mexico or wherever. This had the advantage that means you can often sidestep the region restrictions and stream movies and TV programs from all around the world. And I'll tell you what I'm going to be streaming later today in memory of the late James Caan.
Well, that's going to be one of two things. It's either The Godfather or Misery.
It could be The Godfather. I watched The Godfather only the other week, actually. I watched The Godfather, interestingly, after having reread The Godfather, the original book. Have you ever read it?
No.
Anyway, I watched The Godfather again recently. So the one I'll be watching is Misery, which is, I've always had a particular soft spot for, since it led me to believe, because it starts with the scene where James Caan, playing a best-selling author, is finishing a book. And he always has standing by the special things that help him celebrate the ending of a book. And what are those things?
Oh, if I remember right, it's a bottle of champagne on ice with a champagne glass. And I think he has it might even be a ready-rolled cigarette and a non-safety match ready to light it. And he picks it up and he smells the tobacco as he pours the glass of champagne.
It's a single...
And also he writes the end.
In longhand
to make it quite clear what's going on. I'm a novelist, I finished a book.
You know. Absolutely, he's doing it on a manual steam typewriter kind of thing. So he's putting the last sheet on the top of the pile of manuscript pages, and he actually writes longhand the end. And he has a glass of champagne, glass of Dom Perignon, actually, if I remember correctly. And also a smoke of his single lucky strike that he's had standing by to finish the book. And then sets off down the post office to post the manuscript to his agent or publisher or whatever. And I won't spoil it for anybody else by saying what happens when he sets off down the mountainside.
It's Shotgun by Junior Walker and the All-Stars is playing, isn't it?
There you go.
God, there are some terrifying moments in that film.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Oh, my Lord. The one where he finds the press. Let's not ruin anybody's enjoyment.
No, absolutely.
It's fantastic.
So it's all there. It's all there, available, no doubt, on the internet. So you can take advantage of a deal where you can try NordVPN by going to nordvpn.com/yourear. That's us, word in your ear. Your ear, or just use the code Your Ear to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan and one additional month for free and a bonus gift. It's risk-free because there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. Full details in the show notes below.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
It's the return, the slight return of the Stack Waddy game.
Hooray!
Hooray! Hurrah! The sky is black with chapeau. Inspired, in my case, by the massive current heat wave. Do you remember that Ben and Jerry had a flavour of ice cream called Cherry Garcia? And still do, actually.
Do indeed.
And I just wondered if there'd be any more developments.
That's a good one.
Music-related Ben and Jerry ice cream flavours.
I know part of this. Go on. All right.
I have five possible Ben and Jerry flavours that I'm going to run off for you here. Four of which are real and one is fictional.
Okay. Fine. Okay, bring it on.
Ben and Jerry's current range includes Glastonbury. Okay. Glastonbury.
Yeah.
It includes Bohemian Raspberry. Okay. There's One Sweet World, spelled W-H-I-R-L-E-D. All right. One Sweet World. There's Tangled Up in Blueberry.
God, I didn't know any of these.
Yeah. And this, of course, contains an American idiom, but there's Goodbye Yellow Brickle Road.
Wow.
Now, one of those is fictitious and the other four exist.
God, those are all completely new to me. Because I thought that the better known kind of music related Ben and Jerry flavors, apart from Cherry Garcia, are the likes of fish food.
That's right, fish food.
You know, all those things named after jam bands.
Fish food is real. Yeah.
That is real. God, I'm going to have a wild guess that Bohemian Raspberry is not real.
That is real.
Wow.
That is real. Oh, no. Glastonbury is real, created in 2006 to commemorate Britain's biggest annual festival, a base of vanilla ice cream with fudge brownies and berry swirls. Now, Bohemian Raspberry is, raspberry swirls and fudge brownie chunks. Proceeds to the, part of the proceeds to the Mercury Phoenix Trust. One Sweet World is a play, obviously, on the Dave Matthews song. And that's an environmental charity fundraiser. Yellow Brickle Road, rather giving it away, actually. Chocolate ice cream with peanut butter, cookie dough, butter, brickle, and white chocolate chunks.
So are you telling me that there is no such flavour as Tangled Up in Blueberry?
That's right. It is apparently under consideration in the thing that I was looking at. But I'm surprised they haven't had it all, as is Cinnamon Swirl, which would appeal to any Neil Young fans.
That's true.
It is. I win. There is no Tangled Up in Blueberry. Go on, what do you got for me? You've got what?
These are, I don't know if you ever look at Apple Music. On Apple Music, they have the forever codifying categories of music. They have kind of channels and they have essentials of, not just jazz, but jazz 1959 or bebop or hard bop or post-bop or whatever. Yeah. There are devils for classifications. So what I'm going to give you is I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I have before me 10 lists, 10 names of categories of music on Apple Music, one of which doesn't exist as a category on Apple Music.
That's okay. Good.
Okay. All the rest do.
That's very good.
And here we go. Are you ready? The first one is Manoush jazz. Manouche, jazz.
Yep.
The second one is tropical house. Tropical house. The third one, number three, dance punk. Dance punk.
Yeah.
Number four is swamp rock. Swamp rock. Number five is quiet storm. And number six, folktronica. And number seven, countrypolitan. And number eight, pillow talk. And number nine, J-jazz. And finally, jangle pop. Okay, 10 categories that have their own essentials page on Apple Music. What is the one that I've just invented? Or doesn't
some of those
have?
I pretty much know, I think. Jangle pop, certainly. Pillow talk sounds likely, doesn't it? What was the funk one again? It was folktronica, wasn't it? Was that right?
Folktronica.
That, yeah. I think, is absolutely right. I'm going to go, because it sounds so ridiculous and it must be made up, countrypolitan.
No, countrypolitan, long
is that
established.
Real?
Countrypolitan existed as a genre in the 1960s. Yeah, yeah, still around.
Oh, yeah. Right. Go on now. Which is the ringer?
The one that doesn't have a category in Apple Music, amazingly, is swamp rock.
Oh, my God, that's swamp rock. I didn't even bother to query that, because it's so... That's just a kind of classic kind of, rock hack invention, really, isn't it, I suppose? And
it doesn't exist on Apple Music as a category. All the rest do. Manouche jazz, do you know what Manouche jazz
is? No,
I
don't
know. It's kind of Gypsy Kings jazz. That's what it means.
Yeah.
Do you know what J-jazz is?
No.
Japanese jazz.
Okay.
Because the other thing about this Apple Music, it's a completely international thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So stuff arises from different territories and has some kind of presence. So, but still, there is no Apple Essentials list for Swamp Rock, which I think
is wrong.
It needs correcting.
It's a whole bowl of wrong
as possible.
It is.
It's a whole bowl of gumbo and wrong. It is. Wrong, wrong, wrong.
Wrongity, wrong.
Wrong.
The Word Podcast. Prime cuts of popular culture served fresh each week.
I'm sure you've been following the story, which I find absolutely fascinating, of Bob Dylan's recent auction for a one-off recording of one of his songs. And, I mean, as you know, the story is that Dylan no longer owns, Columbia owns his copyrights and Universal Music owns his publishing. And he's constantly looking for new ways to make money out of his music, out of recorded music, apart from just playing.
Can we just point out, Bob Dylan likes a quid.
He loves a quid.
He loves a quid.
He's got a few of them already, but he wants more.
He likes a quid. As David Geffen memorably said many, many years ago, he said, "I've talked to lots of artists, and Bob Dylan is no exception in being really interested in money."
Absolutely.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with it.
I don't blame him. I mean, it's not undignified at all.
Not at all.
But he did that thing, that Shadow Kingdom concert, I think it was last year, which is, again, a way he re-recorded some of the back catalogue and put it up for streaming, and you had to pay $25 to watch or whatever. So he's trying out new versions of ways of making money out of a catalogue that he no longer owns. And the ruse he came up with was that on the 60th anniversary of its original recording, which I think was July the 9th, 1962, he and T-Bone Burnett and various other people had recorded a one-off recording of Blowing in the Wind, done in one take. Okay, again, classic Dylan, minimum amount of work.
Yes, minimum effort.
One take. It's not like he labored over this for hours, But anyway, it's a one take. So the idea is that this was done using a new kind of long in development format called Ionic Originals, which supposedly has more faithful, rendering of real sound than vinyl, and unique coating and all this sort of. I don't pretend to understand it, but anyway, it's some new fabulous format where it sounds absolutely incredible. So what they did is they recorded this one track. They pressed it up on this one disc, this soul disc. They put it in a very, very expensive box, etc. And they put it up for auction. And somebody has apparently bought it for just around £1.5 million. which is an astonishing story. I mean, in principle, it's really interesting because obviously music is now, you know, limitlessly copyable and therefore virtually valueless. Everybody can have it. If you produce a piece of music that cannot be copied, that is as original as an artwork. So the Mona Lisa, there is only one Mona Lisa, to choose a very obvious example. And what you're buying is a physical artifact, which of which there are no replicas. There is only one that was ever made. So they're doing a version of that. But I mean, the thing that struck me was two things. One, obviously there are copies of that recording. They have the copies. If those copies ever got out, it would devalue the recording, wouldn't it? It wouldn't be worth anything if it got bootlegged. I mean, that's the whole thing, is you're buying for 1.5 million the right to be the sole owner of that piece of music. So they must be protecting that fantastically carefully. In fact, built into the deal is probably some insurance against that that thing ever getting bootlegged, which would devalue it.
Right? Well, except that, yeah, okay, I see what you're saying. But presumably, this is being treated as any kind of precious commodity would be in the kind of art market, which it will have to become accompanied by certificates accounting for its provenance.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you have to be able to prove that you bought that one from Bob Dylan and T-Bone Nat.
Yeah. But on the understanding,
on this date,
there was no.
Well, except. You still don't really mind about that because you've got that one, and yours will always be more valuable than whatever the copies are of it, you know, because you got the first one. You know, it's like there are a million copies of the Mona Lisa, but you own, you know, the Louvre have got the one, haven't they?
Yeah.
Do we have any clue who bought it?
No, there's no clue who bought it.
Is it, I put it to you, Mark Ellen, is it not possible that it was bought by a museum or some kind of place like that that plans to exhibit it in some way, and that people might be able to go around and look at it and listen to it, albeit, you know, kind of, you know, they buy a ticket to do it?
Well, that's a possibility, isn't it? Because if you're an individual owning it, I'm trying to think whether or not it'd be as the equivalent in terms of satisfaction as owning a priceless artwork. If you owned a fantastically famous Picasso, the joy of that surely is that after dinner, with a balloon glass of brandy, you take your pals up to your perfectly temperature controlled room and high security bunker where you keep this painting, and you look at the painting. You're in the presence of the painting, which must be pretty fantastic, actually.
Mm.
But in this case, I mean, you're looking at a box with a record in it, and I suppose you sit down and play. Every time you play it, I imagine its value is to, would it decrease the quality?
Well, I don't know. I mean, that used to be the case with an acetate.
Yeah,
it would. Like that you can only play them a limited number of times.
Yeah.
It's funny, I was reading about recently the first big best-selling record in Britain, I think I'm right in saying this, was a recording of Ode for the Wings of a Dove done by a chorister called Ernest something, I've forgotten his second name.
Yeah.
Must have been just after the First World War. And this was a massive seller, sold millions, huge numbers. To such an extent that they wore out the original master recording and had to make another one before they could press further. Because, you know, the master...
But didn't people spot that it was different?
Well, they wouldn't be able to compare and contrast, presumably. I don't know, you know. I just...
Someone who had the old version would say, hang on, this is not quite the same. Is it the same bloke?
Well, no, it was the same chorister, but I think he was about 3 years older.
So it's probably his voice is broken.
Slightly less effective boy soprano second time round.
Brilliant.
But, you know, that's one thing nobody will be complaining about with Bob.
It's Bob's a good story, don't you think? And of course, T-Bone Burnett has said, we're going to do lots more of them. Well, you would, wouldn't you?
The Word Podcast, two cocoa tins and a piece of string.
So we're joined by Alex Gold, and Alex is preparing at the moment to go off to Italy, is it? Alex, I think it is.
Yes, it's the Amalfi Coast next weekend to play a wedding.
To play what you described to us as an indie wedding. Now, indie wedding, that Indie weddings have come on somewhat if they're now on the Amalfi Coast. Rather than Kettering in Northampton.
Yeah.
Whatever. But anyway, you said you had to rehearse because you're in the band. You had to rehearse a kind of indie repertoire for the indie couple whose wedding it is. And amongst this repertoire, you said you had a tune by The Killers, okay, which prompted me to wonder what the jiggins is indie about The Killers, which you will now explain to us, Alex.
Well, it's not that The Killers now are indie, because they're most definitely not indie.
They were once.
I remember.
It's possible to actually change your status as regards indie. An R&B band doesn't stop being an R&B band when they're massively successful, do they? But an indie group can. This is interesting.
Yeah, The Killers are now not indie, but they were once indie, and that you can it can extrapolate the indie from any given band. So, for example, The Killers' first album, Hot Fuss, was absolutely indie, 100% indie. And Mr. Brightside is probably the quintessential indie banger. If you were to ask any indie person on the street, if you were to hoik, you know, someone with the floppy fringe and skinny jeans off any given street in Camden and ask them what the quintessential indie banger was, they would immediately go, without even blinking, Mr. Brightside, good sir.
But you see, I've always thought of the Killers as being a little bit polished and a bit rock and a bit slick and a bit of a performance.
That first album, though,
from Las Vegas, aren't they? I mean,
but all their influences were British indie. I mean, you can hear it on that first. You can really hear it on that first album. The rhythm section's really high in the mix. The way it's put together, that first album is 100% indie. But you know, it's kind of sparkly.
So, who are the godfathers of indie? Is it people like Orange Juice? Those kind of scratchy, shambling kind of, you know, amateurish early 80s.
I don't know, because indie is a tree with many trunks, I feel. And, you know,
I'm going to interrupt for a second, because, Mark, you and I, again, we're old enough to remember when the term indie started to be used.
Yeah.
So we remember a time before indie. I put it to you, my lord. Young Alex Gold doesn't remember that. Alex Gale was born into a world where the word indie was frankly bandied around, probably in his cradle. Is that right, Alex?
Yes, that's absolutely right. I'm a latecomer.
I think that's interesting.
It is.
I'm not.
Never knew the world before indie.
There you go.
Yeah, come on, seriously. What? Who started? Where did it start?
He doesn't know, because he was there.
I want to know this.
Oh, I couldn't tell. I'm not claiming to know. To kind of be the sage of indie at all, because indie is a fluid concept as well. My indie is different to your indie, for example. It's like our experience of colours or smells. You know, everybody's experience is slightly different, and you know, depending on kind of where you are in the chronological spectrum, I suppose. You know, so my indie is completely different to your indie, which would be completely different to Andrew Harrison's indie, which would be, you know, the Smiths and all that kind of stuff. My indie, you know, my indie originated. My indie year dot was Oasis. I mean, that was when I, and of course, Oasis transcended indie because they became massive and therefore not indie. But, you know, there was a period where they encapsulated the essence of what indie was, whatever that was.
And was that? Now, can we ask you, what was that?
It was being slightly outside of the mainstream, having guitars and having drums that sounded a certain way, I think. And also dressing like your friends.
One day, I love that. Love is what you wore. It's like wearing the clothes that you were wearing on stage that you wore off stage. I mean,
Which The Killers obviously did not do, because Brandon Flowers has always been a natty dresser. But indie evolved again. Indie kind of split into two in the noughties. You got the more kind of sparkly, spangly strand of indie, which was The Killers, The Strokes. And then you got the more urchin, sort of grubby kind of street indie from The Libertines. You know, it became a multifaceted faction thing. But, you know, indie's like a liquid. It's not a solid. You know, it's not a cake you can divide into pieces. It's a fluid kind of, like, squidgy mass that you're constantly swimming in, but never really...
Is this getting any clearer, Dave? Indie's like a liquid. I get it.
I'm sorry. I think this is really interesting. Yeah. It's really interesting. Now, would you say, I put it to you, Mr. Gold, that you cannot be an indie band once you are really successful? Because when bands are successful, they kind of look successful. They have a kind of glow to them.
Oh, totally.
And this is inconsistent with being indie, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I suppose you could like it's a nuanced thing, and there are many elements into making up one's indiness, and you could probably put them all on the pie chart. I mean, you probably wouldn't want to, but you know, you could. And one of those elements is level of success, for sure. You know, and once your level of success defines the percentage of indie you are by degrees.
Right.
But, yeah, once you start selling millions and gazillions and squillions of records, you stop being indie. Absolutely, by proxy. You can't be indie and be massive. The two things are mutually exclusive. They just don't work. But indie's kind of, you know, it's a corridor that you pass through on the route to massive.
So it's nothing to do with, there's so many different types of indie. It's nothing to do with kind of willful amateurishness, is there? Because there's another kind of indie. We did a thing with Nigel Tassel, who's written a book about the C86.
Yeah.
About Bogshed. He says Alan McGee came to see us play in London, and he said he wasn't sure if he'd just seen the best band in the world or the worst band in the world. So that kind of being catastrophically awful and unambitious is not part of it, magic, is it?
No, I suppose it is, but this once again goes back to the notion that indie is a completely kind of fluid, kind of, you know, malleable sea of different things, you know, and everybody's indie is slightly different. It is a really nebulous concept, you know, but being awful and really small and bad at playing your music is part of being indie, absolutely, you know, but also having a cool haircut and decent shoes but not selling millions of records, that's also being indie.
Can I just say and I did point this out years ago in a best-selling book about rock stars, that the key thing about rock stars is their footwear. Footwear, hugely important.
Shoes and hair. It all starts and ends with the top and the bottom.
Everything
in between doesn't really matter. It's not really about the music, sure.
That's really true.
It's about your fringe and how pointy your toes are. Really.
So I must point out to people listening that Alex Gold is about to fly to Italy, to the Amalfi Coast in July. And he will be carrying with him, or pulling along behind him, a suitcase about the size of a magician's wardrobe, you know, containing, and this suitcase will contain not one pair of Doc Martens, which some of you might think was surplus to requirement for Italy.
Anyway, in the Amalfi Coast in the summer.
Italy in July.
Yeah, absolutely.
No. He's taking two that he's admitted to already, and he may, at the last minute,
panic,
fling it,
and take a third.
Take a third. Yeah. Pair of docks to the Amalfi Coast. Defend yourself, Alex Gold.
Well, you got options. You know, I mean, God, you know what happens if the shirt you pick doesn't go with your mahogany vegan Doc Martens? It's a disaster. You know, you can't have
the wedding's off.
You can't possibly expect it to be able to rock with the wrong shoe shirt combination. But in my defence, I will say that I don't know why I'm pointing to a suitcase. It isn't there, but I'll be wearing one pair of Docs, and one pair will be in the suitcase because they're quite heavy as well, so they do affect the weight of the thing. But I will be taking a pair of Converse as well, and a pair of white sneakers just in case, because white sneakers go with absolutely everything. So, you know.
I want to know whether, because you were talking about certain bands, certain indie bands, it's no longer okay to like.
Yes, it's a
growing
list.
This is very interesting. So if I gave you a few notes, I mean, you can still like Oasis.
Yeah, that's fine.
Obviously, but you can't like the Stone Roses?
No, you can. It's tricky to like Ian Brown as an entity.
Yeah.
I think it's fine to like the Stone Roses. I think, you know, they can't tar Rennie and Manny and John Squire with Ian Brown's mucky voice.
All you're talking about is Ian Brown's kind of unconventional political opinions.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's all it took. All it took to get him cast out of the indie world, which means that the one thing that the indie world doesn't tolerate is nonconformity.
No, it's not that. No, I don't think the indie world doesn't.
That's a really clever point.
That is interesting. I think, you know, as indie gets bigger and less indie, then, of course, the concept of nonconformity becomes a bit of a
It's huge. Yeah. Alex, yeah. It's hugely conformist. It's the most conformist subculture in the history of popular music.
I think you're right. I think you're right. I think it started off with the best of intentions, but it has definitely become...
gradually gone more and more
by the rules.
More mainstream by the boxes. Mainstream.
I mean, Morrissey's been effectively booted out, hasn't he?
Yes.
Which you understand, but I mean, it's just that he doesn't fit the template anymore.
Well, no, I think in the case of Ian Brown and Morrissey, it's indie people taking a stand against other indie people being arses, which I think is fair enough. I think there's a degree, there is room for individualism there, of course there is. But in Morrissey and Ian Brown, a very extreme case, you know, it wouldn't matter if they're in a metal subculture or a K-pop subculture. I'd like to think that, you know, given their recent, you know, personality quirk developments, they'd have been ostracised anywhere just because they've been legitimate arses, you know, and not very palatable people. And I think that's fair enough, you know, that's absolutely fair enough.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Who else is no longer acceptable?
It's difficult to like Razorlight.
Why?
Again, because of the singer. And it nearly always is, actually.
This is really good. Yeah. Persona non indie.
No,
this is,
yeah.
This is a new category.
A friend of mine's got a really good, interesting theory about singers and why a lot of singers tend to be a little bit difficult. Quirky, to be kind about it, and that's because he seems to think that if you learn to play an instrument, and you learn to play an instrument when you're a child or a teenager, within that package comes virtues like patience. You teach yourself how to be patient and how to be measured and all those qualities that help sort of round you as a person. Whereas if you're a pop singer or a rock singer, you probably haven't studied it at all. You know, you probably just get thrown into a band and just expect it to happen instantaneously. Yep. And that sort of becomes a maxim for your life. And, you know, of course, that if that spills out into other areas, it makes you incredibly difficult. But
in their defence, defence of lead singers, I put it to you, Mr. Gold, again.
Okay.
They have twice as much courage as the rest of the group.
Because
they have to. They go stand there on their own. There's nothing
to hide behind.
There's nothing between their or the audience's scrutiny and their genital area. Not whatsoever. This is a feeling of vulnerability that most people could not deal with. Mick Jagger did this before he was famous. So it took unbelievable nerve to do this.
Yeah, before absolutely.
They've all done that.
It's either extreme courage or just a complete lack of shame. And maybe it's both at the same time, you know.
Well, it's a bit... I don't know if Mark would agree with this, but I used to find years ago when I was on the telly years ago. I could never watch myself.
We've had this conversation
before. Unless I stood behind a door. A sofa.
Really?
Put
a pillow on my lap or do something like that. Yeah, you just
seriously
be hunched up, hugging your knees. And I'm afraid to say this is just a psychological thing. It's about defending a part of your body that makes you feel incredibly exposed.
Whereas guitarists have an enormous great plank of wood and metal in between them and the audience, which they hide behind, frankly. The singer doesn't at all. So I'm saying respect to the singer. But I know where your mate's coming from in terms of discipline. Well, that's, you know, that's, I like to feel that has been a valuable addition to a debate.
I've learned a lot, I've got to be honest.
This is a junction in the Word podcast. It separates that bit from this next bit.
We recorded this on Sunday morning ahead of the Wimbledon men's final with Nick Kyrgios and Novak Djokovic. So we don't know what the outcome's going to be, but I'm going to be intrigued to see if Kyrgios wins, which is a big if, how he reacts to the moment of kind of triumph. Because having seen him, like you and I did, we went to Wimbledon on Monday.
We saw him on Monday.
On Monday. Yeah. And we got an opportunity to observe at close quarters at some length, because it was a long old match. His whole kind of demeanor on court, which seems to me to be, I can't quite decide whether it's punk rock or it's hip hop. It's hip hop, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an extension of that thing we've talked about before, you know, the idea of being a rock and roll sports person or a rock and roll chef or a rock and roll politician or rock and roll entrepreneur or whatever. And he's a classic rock and roll sports person, but it's kind of hip hop because firstly, he walks with a kind of hip hop roll.
He does.
Doesn't he? A proper roll. And
he walks like a person who's not an athlete at all.
Yeah, he's kind of crouched as if permanently in pain. And that's another thing. When we were watching him, he suddenly seemed to suggest that his shoulder was giving him grief.
Yeah,
and so he's clutching his shoulder and he looked preoccupied about that. And at one point, he actually called in a physio, which is, of course, a destabilizing thing for the opposition because suddenly everybody's got to stop and somebody comes in and has a word with you. But, I mean, we couldn't work out, could we, whether or not he really did have a bad shoulder or whether this was some kind of attitude ruse thing that he was using, again, to psychologically hold his opponent below the waterline. You just can't tell. The other thing is that nothing is ever his fault.
Ever.
Nothing is his fault. So if he misses a shot, he starts to look around the crowd as if to point at somebody who might have distracted him. Or, you know, or if there's a decision given against him, he'll have a go at the umpire and call the umpire bro. Hey, bro. She's absolutely, it's so kind of, it's so hip hop.
It's doubly insulting when applied to a French umpire somehow, calling a French umpire bro.
There's no idea what you're talking about.
Absolutely ridiculous.
I know.
And the other thing is, he doesn't have critics. He has haters.
He has haters.
That's a very hip hop thing.
It is.
It's the idea that you don't just hate me, you hate me and my people.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
And the other thing, I still can't, I know he's not the only person who does this, but I couldn't help thinking, who in their right mind undertakes an athletic endeavor at the highest possible level while wearing a backwards baseball cap? Is there anything more uncomfortable, more distracting than the backwards baseball cap, which is always catching in your neck?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? The idea that he's incapable of hitting a shot without wearing a backwards baseball cap, it's so hip-hop, isn't it?
Couldn't take it off. He can't be separated from that because that's just such a big part of his identity, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Other thing I noticed that he does is it's now absolutely standard, whether you mean it or you don't, and I'm sure they do mean it, is that when the victor gets the interview, seconds after the loser has had to kind of limp off back to the dressing room, you know, it's death or glory, isn't it? They always start by saying, look, you know, all credit to the person that just played. They were fantastic. I'm not better than them. I just happen to be lucky enough to be better than them today or whatever. It was a, does Nick Kyrgios ever do that? No, Dave, he doesn't. At no point does he ever acknowledge that that he was up against particularly difficult opposition.
No. So I can't. I'll be intrigued to see how he reacts this afternoon, because if he loses, he's going to have to blame it on somebody, and if he wins, he's going to have to do that thing that comes most, you know, it comes with most difficulty to people like that, which is to say how delighted he is he's won. Because his body language at the moment is, I didn't even want to be here. They make me do this.
I know there were moments when we were watching when he seemed to throw it away. He would just, there were a couple of cases where he simply just batted it out, just deliberately lost the point. And again, was that to throw the opposition and then to lull them into a false sense of security? You can't tell. You made a really, really good point. You were saying it's a bit like an indie band being at the Brits.
At the Brits.
You know, it's that idea that, you know, they'd love to win, but they can't be seen to care want to about win. It.
No, absolutely.
Because that would be wrong. That would be accepting a load of values that they don't subscribe to.
So anyway, that's Wimbledon. I was at the Wireless Festival is taking place not far from me this weekend in Finsbury Park. And I went down there on yesterday just to see my son. So I was going through Finsbury Park because they were all coming off to go to the Wireless Festival. And the thing that struck me was that I said to my son, is the main demographic for the Wireless Festival, is it 15-year-old girls? He said, yes, it is this weekend. And we went and looked at the bill. And the bill is Nicki Minaj and Cardi B. And it's you know, the stars are pretty much all female of the Wireless Festival. And so there's these girls trooping off the tube, all wearing crop tops and shorts, and all carrying one thing, which is a phone, you know, festooned with kind of glitter.
Yeah.
And all looking
at a rubbery pink case with sparkles on it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they're all looking as if they're setting off to have the most brilliant time, because the weather this weekend's fantastic. Fantastic for them. But it really makes you think, you know, that 15-year-old girls nowadays go to see women in their 20s. Is that, you know, because those are the big stars, aren't they?
They are.
You know what I mean? Clearly there are still kind of scream idols, but they're not as many as they used to be. It's, you know, they go and see women in their 20s who are kind of, you know, stars of, you know, YouTube and Instagram and so forth, and whose moves they can no doubt exactly emulate,
replicate.
That's a huge just part of the fun, isn't it? It's the kind of fun of being together and the fun of all doing those songs together. You know, it's a hugely social
mass
thing.
Dance routine.
It's a mass dance,
and it's a completely different thing from Glastonbury, isn't it?
It appears
totally different thing, because I think Glastonbury is a camping event. I think there's a major division between camping festivals and one-day festivals. One-day festivals, you turn up, you get a bit pissed, you know, you see the acts, you go home, you come the next day, whatever. But camping festival, it's a whole thing, is the experience of being there. There's a certain amount of suffering involved, isn't there?
Absolutely.
A certain amount of, we're all in this together, us against adversity. And it's not all about the entertainment. And also, it's quite a middle-class thing. You know, it's people with camping equipment. It's people who like camping. And there aren't that many 15-year-old girls who are necessarily up for that.
It's also people who've been raised in the belief that you're supposed to suffer for your fun.
Completely.
It's a very middle-class thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're not here to enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Word Podcast, where the time is whenever you want it to be.
And so we're joined by our Patreon birthday boy, Patrick Cleesby. Hello, Patrick. When was the birthday?
It was a week ago on Wednesday.
All right. So you're over that now.
I'm kind of over it, yeah.
What was done to celebrate it?
I went to see St. Vincent at Hammersmith Odeon.
Oh, very nice.
I'm glad to see you still call it Hammersmith Odeon. We're only having this discussion the other day with another birthday boy in Boston, Massachusetts. And we're discussing the fact that even in Boston, Massachusetts, I think there's a venue. Did he say it was called the Waterside, Mark? I think
that's right.
And it's changed its name about 50 years ago, and people refuse to observe it.
I know.
And I like to feel That's something that unites the brotherhood of music fans all over the world. They refuse to recognize the changing names of venues. Absolutely, definitely. So listen, as is customary on these occasions, you've got a log that you'd like to throw on the conversational fire here.
I have.
Which is word of your ear. What is it?
Well, it's two-part, really, but it's semi-prompted by your observation about Petula Clark.
All right.
The day. Yeah. Because I had a very similar one about the same week. I'm actually back at the BBC and I'm in Television Centre. I'm in the basement underneath the ITV studio.
So tell us, first of all, what happens at Telly Centre nowadays? Because it was all sold, wasn't it?
Well, I'm in the repeats department again after 15 years away, and ITV are upstairs. So they shoot Good Morning Britain and loose Women and stuff.
Oh, there. I see. Okay.
Oh, wow.
And there's bits of... There's a Soho house, which I haven't been to yet. And
It's been sold off as apartments, hasn't it?
Yeah.
So some of the producers, some of the people we used to work with actually bought basically apartments that were where their old office used to be.
I think Alan Yentob's got one.
Yes, he has, I think.
I think Alan Jones has got one.
Yeah.
But no, the initial observation was when they were doing it, I went around, looked around the bottom end, and the fourth floor centre wedge where you used to work and I used to work, because it became entertainment and comedy post sort of suites after you guys did Whistle Test there. It's not there at all. They ripped a hole out the back of the building and the whole wedge isn't there. It just goes round at the back, all the apartment bits.
Right.
So I was just interested in whether you guys have been to see it, whether you miss it, how you feel about it.
No, not been to see it. We had a kind of odd relationship with the place, because a lot of the time we did Whistle Test, the offices of Whistle Test were across the road in a building which I think at the time was called Centre House, wasn't
it? That's right. Yeah. It was, yeah.
Which is probably still there. I think you still see it when you pull into White City on the tube. I think
it's been raised now.
Oh, has it? Okay.
Yeah. Right. Amazon Fresh there.
Right. There you go. So we that was where the Whistle Test office was. And Whistle Test used to be done partly at Telly Centre, partly in Manchester, because they used to, do Oxford Road or whatever, and also partly a Riverside in Hammersmith, didn't it, Mark?
Yeah, we had a whole series there, actually, with live recordings, but with live audience, yeah.
Yeah, and I think when I did the first one, it was, what was the name of the studio? Way down in Surrey, the place, not Elstree, what am I talking about? The one that the Who took. I can't remember.
Begins with a T, doesn't it?
I can't remember. It was way down there, so we were all over the place. We were very much the kind of Cinderella of the BBC, it only appeared on the telly after the snooker had finished.
That's right.
Quarter past 11.
I think it was the Bob days when it was in Pres A and Pres B in the fourth
quarter. Oh, yeah, it would be. Yeah. We were in bigger studios than that when it was a telly centre. But... You're wondering about bumping into people.
Yeah, so the same week you mentioned Pet, I saw Cliff Richard at the top of my stairs.
There you go.
And it's the ones that really give you a bit, because it's a legend,
Yeah, absolutely.
But I have a few personal ones that in the music area. I've got some acting ones. Well, I saw, my son's a drummer, and I saw Dave Grohl sitting on one of the bollards in the donut smoking a fag, and I was dying to go and talk to him, but I thought that's not the form. You don't do that.
Dave Grohl
sitting on a bollard. That's good, I think. Yeah. That's a major spot.
But I had three in quick succession. Then I had the only one I saw with like a couple of female autograph hunters hanging off him was the massive sight of Brian May in his clogs. Same kind of area. A couple of days later. So that was quite impressive. But no, the one that really blew my mind was three in a row in quick succession. I kind of went in the old reception. There was Stuart Copeland standing there. Right. Like, not worthy. And I got in the lift and Griffiths Jones was next to me, and I was a big Not 9 o'clock News fan. Right. And I was just walking around to some suites of ours and Charlie Higson bowled around the corner and I nearly knocked him over. And I was just going, this is doing my head in.
This is a classic day, isn't it?
I've had two odd experiences, and one at BBC and one elsewhere years ago. My God, years ago, 1976 or whatever. I was working at a record plugger and I was in Manchester. I'd gone to see Tony Wilson, who at the time was just starting to run So It Goes. And I was with Tony in his office. He said, let's go for a drink in the club at lunchtime. And the Granada used to have a little place called The Stables, which is around the corner from Granada Studios. And so we went in there and we had a drink. And I was just sitting there in this bar full of normal people, technicians, whatever. And I was looking around and suddenly I got the weirdest experience, which is that the members of the cast of Coronation Street are all in the bar.
That's fantastic.
They're all dotted around all over the place. So there's Len Fairclough talking to somebody from World in Action or whatever. There's Hilda Ogden speaking to somebody from Accounts. Why is she not with Stan? He's over there. And honestly, that is one of the weirdest things I've ever seen, because more than rock stars, and particularly in those days, these people, their faces were so familiar to you. You know what I mean? Mm. You knew them better than you knew members of your own family, almost, you know. And to see them in a place like that is a jolt I never got over at all. I've never seen anything like that. But the
it seemed like a confused dream, wouldn't it? Because they're all familiar. Really? And you think, hang on, wait a minute. Absolutely. Put these people together.
Some of them were in costume, some of them weren't, just really odd. But the thing about the BBC and the Pat Clark thing, who I saw in that little bit just off the reception in Wogan House, where people do interviews down the line, used to be very busy. The other thing about Wogan House is, if you meet people in the lifts, Wogan House has the world's smallest lifts.
Mm, I've only been in once, I think.
Absolutely.
So you're squashed in with them, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. There's barely room for you. There wouldn't be room for you and Leslie West out of Mountain. It's simply, not on the car.
With us.
No, not anymore. No, absolutely. You couldn't get in the lift with the small faces, It was just to be absolutely impossible. But the one that it struck me is a few years ago. This was in I was in a reception of Broadcasting House itself, the very splendid old reception, which is not used all that much, really. And with a fabulous kind of curving cushioned bench going round there, isn't there? And I'm sitting there, and on my right are all the members of Ladysmith Black Mambazo.
There's quite a few of them.
Quite a few. And on my left is Ronnie Corbett.
Oh, that's fantastic. What a combination.
So
I engaged in animated conversation.
I just thought, this is glorious. This is a perfect memory of the BBC.
Yeah.
Because there they were, and God knows what they're on their way to. I don't know, front row or God knows what. God knows what Ronnie Corbett was doing there or whatever. Ronnie Corbett, mark you, whose legs were so short, they didn't reach the ground.
His feet were dangling like a schoolboy. Was he wearing shorts?
And I thought, these two acts, if you like, are both, in their way, extraordinarily famous.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Everybody's got Ladysmith Black Mambazo records somewhere, haven't they? And clearly everybody knows that Ronnie Corbett is. But clearly, neither of them knew who the other were. And I'm in the middle, and I'm almost wanted to introduce them.
Ronnie, do you know? Excuse me, do you know?
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And
that reception was always. I can remember seeing both Michael Palin and David Attenborough in there at second on occasions, and being incredibly excited on their way, presumably just to do a program, and sharing a lift with David Attenborough, which is not having the nerve to talk to him.
It doesn't very really exciting. Go away, does it? No. When they're big figures, it's
it's extraordinary.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's kind of how I felt about Petula Clark not that long ago. I thought, for crying out loud, that's bloody Petula Clark. I don't care about the latest indie sensation. She's been famous since I can remember, kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's the thing about that kind of fame. It's I often think it's like footballers. You can only ever be really impressed by the people who were big stars when you were a child. That's the thing that never goes away. Somebody comes along more recently, they're never quite as big.
Well, it's that theory we've got that you can't have a hero who's younger than you, isn't it? They have to be older as well.
Yeah. So, well, keep us informed of what's going on and what they don't even call it Television Centre anymore.
It's still called Television Centre. It just doesn't say BBC in front of it. It's still got the same Television Centre graphic.
I say it's still got really stroppy security men.
No, it's got a bit, I think it's got a bit laxer than it used to be. It's like, I forget my past, there just always another one, steady.
It used to be,
anyone could get in.
The joke used to be that it was a nightmare trying to get through the gate, even if you were presenting a television programme. But once you were in, nobody ever stopped you going anywhere at all. You know,
there's still a guy in a box out the front to just sort of checking goods deliveries and stuff like that.
Right, right. Well, look, nice to talk to you, Patrick.
Very good to see you, Patrick.
Happy birthday as of a week ago.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you for your support.
The Word Podcast. Clearly, there is no plan.
So, any other business?
Mention the various pods we've just done with various interviews. We've done all sorts of interesting people, haven't we?
Go on.
Chris Blackwell, he of Ireland Records, he's written a memoir. And just lovely bits of that where he's talking about early life in Jamaica. And I mean, how impressive is this? His memories include Noel Coward being round the house, being impossibly witty. That's good.
We always had Noel round.
Noel Coward couldn't get rid of him.
Every weekend.
And Ian Fleming, because of course they finished up buying the Golden Eye Estate. And
my dad used to draw the curtains when he thought Noel Coward.
We'll lie on the floor quiet.
Get behind the sofa. Terrence Rattigan's coming round.
Yeah.
Who's that at the front door? Celia Johnson, keep your voice down.
We've heard all her gags before. Yeah. Told the most of them. Awful. No, he's talking about how I think his mum might have had a bit of a fling with Ian Fleming, actually. Although they had I think they had something going on.
And I think it would have been rude not to, actually. Ian Fleming kind of had a fling with most people. Go on.
And his mum inspired Honeychild Ryder and Dr. No. And Pussy Galore and Goldfinger. That's good work, isn't it?
Good
your
work
mum
now.
Was the inspiration for Pussy Galore.
Did your mum not do that, Mum?
No. It's incredible. There's a lovely bit where he talks about Errol Flynn. So Errol Flynn being round. He said he was the first person he ever saw on water skis. And he used to water ski with his dachshund. That's good, isn't it? That's good.
That's a good name for a book. Water skiing with my dachshund.
Yes.
Yeah. Very good.
And he talked about, it's very good stuff about the making Bob Marley's, making reggae international, being in the studio and watching the various musicians working on Catch a Fire change that sound to make it appealing to basically to white students, wasn't it, really? That was the thing.
Because he overdubbed it in London, didn't he?
Yeah.
Wayne Perkins and Rabbit
Wayne
Bundry.
Perkins put all those guitar parts on it and everything.
Yeah.
So that was good. And who else have we done? We've done Loudon
Wainwright. Loudon Wainwright. We love talking to Loudon Wainwright, who's been an element of our lives for almost as long as we can remember, isn't it?
Yeah, we were asking him if he could still play songs like Motel Blues. And he says he does play them, because obviously they don't quite fit with contemporary values. But he does put in a bit of an apology first, doesn't he? And say, this
he explains the changed social context, which is perfectly fair.
Yeah.
You find the same thing in reading, James Bond novels, I would imagine.
Completely.
Go and read an original Ian Fleming novel.
Yeah.
That'll make your eyes water.
Yeah.
So, Loudon Wainwright. And we also spoke to Julian Lennon.
Oh, we did. That was extraordinary. That was interesting. Yeah, and you felt a bit of sympathy for him. A lot of it was about having the surname Lennon, as he put it, actually, wasn't
it? Absolutely.
And how difficult that life had become, and you can imagine that. But he changed his name by Depot, didn't he?
Yes, just recently.
It was John Julian Lennon. He changed it to Julian John Lennon because, I mean, it sounds like a minor point, but obviously made a massive difference.
I mean, because he used to
customs and they would
present his
John
passport,
Lennon.
The John Lennon.
Okay, like you're John Lennon.
Yeah.
I know. So, no, he was really, really interesting. And he had extraordinarily clear memories, didn't he, about his fifth birthday at Kenwood. Yeah. There's a famous picture with anybody listening probably knows John Lennon holding a hoe and Cynthia holding a mop.
Yeah.
And Julian on his fifth birthday they've got a little birthday cake shaped like a steam engine. And he remembered all that very, very clearly. And then said, but after that, unfortunately, things went a bit pear-shaped. Mm. So it's quite touching. It's good.
So all that stuff's out there on the YouTube channel. And don't forget, if you're looking at any of these things or listening to any of these things, please like them and recommend them and share them and leave comments, preferably favourable ones, because that sort of stuff really makes a massive difference, doesn't it, Alex?
It really does, yeah.
And also, if you feel like being a Patreon supporter, You know, we would very much appreciate that. If you want to find out how you can do that, if you go to patreon.com, word in your ear, what's the different levels people can engage at, Alex?
So there are various tiers, as Dave says, and there, first of all, there is the quiz tier, whereby you gain access to our now legendary weekly quiz.
Friday night.
Every Friday night since 2020.
It takes about 20 minutes. It's not that, it doesn't occupy your really whole Friday evening. Go on.
But it's a lovely little community.
And there's a prize once a month, there's a prize for the winner.
Quince jelly or something like that. Yeah, go on.
And the next tier is the podcast tier, where you get early access to this very podcast every week. You get it before the rest of the world. Then there is the classic podcast tier. This is where things start getting really sexy. So we have the entire archive of the Word podcast dating back to 2007, I think. We rerun select classic pods with a present take on them, courtesy of Mark and Dave. And along with that tier, so along with the classic pods, you also get the weekly Word podcast with full visuals, so you'll be able to see as well as hear us. And you get early access to all of our Word in Your Attics as well. So it's a really, really, really good
deal. It's well worth having.
And at the top of the tree, there's the birthday tier. So you get all of that, plus on your birthday, we come around to your house digitally and rummage through your record collection.
Rummage through your records and take the mickey out of them. That's basically what we do.
It's your big chance to show off your impeccable good taste.
Yeah. And along with that, you also get the audio version of Word in Your Attic, which isn't available anywhere else. So if you want to listen to it on the fly, walking a dog or whatever, you can do that by subscribing to our birthday tier as well. And we're about to announce a very, 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 very cool extra element to that tier, which we can't tell you about just yet. But we'll
absolutely.
Be...
So if you want to get involved, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for further details.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.